rise. The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Seda presiding.
Good morning. Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on the calendar this morning is the matter of Benchmark versus Sparks, case number 46623. And it is my understanding that with the great assistance of our clerk, you have worked out the division of your time. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Very well. Then, Mr. Bick, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do so.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Ken Bick, and I'm representing Benchmark Insurance Company on this appeal. At the request of the clerk, I would like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal time at the end of this argument. She wanted me to specify that at the outset. The question for this court to decide on this appeal is simply this. Who is ultimately responsible for the more than $187,000 in defense costs that Benchmark incurred in defending Robert Sparks in the underlying wrongful death action and subsequent appeal? Is it Benchmark? Is it Mr. Sparks? Or, as I believe the law indicates, should that ultimate responsibility rest with Universal Underwriters, who is the excess carrier? In order to answer that question, this court needs to interpret two different insurance policy provisions, one which is found in the Benchmark policy and one which is found in the Universal policy. Those two issues that need to be construed are simply, number one, since Benchmark's policy states its duty to defend ends once the policy limits have been exhausted, then does Benchmark's act in unconditionally tendering those policy limits to the court in an interpleader action constitute an exhaustion within the meaning of the policy so as to terminate the duty to defend? And number two, is Universal's the most we will pay exclusion, a so-called step-down provision wherein the policy purports to make coverage disappear in the presence of other insurance, is that valid and enforceable? I believe the answer to the second question is clear and probably requires very little discussion. As outlined in my brief, the universal exclusion is invalid and unenforceable for each of three different reasons. The exclusion is tucked away in a remote corner of the policy, some 45 pages from the deck page, which does not set forth any restrictions on the amount of coverage for a permissive user. And as such, it fails the test of conspicuousness. And I cited a recent case from California, the Century Select case, which is directly on point, which recognized such an exclusion is invalid. Second, this exclusion, wherein Universal is basically saying, our policy does not provide coverage under any circumstances at any time to a permissive user, if the permissive user has his own insurance, is what is known in the law as an escape clause. Escape clauses are disfavored by the courts and have routinely been stricken. In fact, it's interesting to note that Universal's own escape clause has been the subject of litigation around the country, and I've cited those cases in which those courts, pun intended, have universally held that Universal's exclusion is invalid.
So you're looking at this strictly as a contract issue and interpretation of the language as opposed to any statutory basis for dual coverage or any case law that we may have addressing that?
The interpretation of the policies is going to be key, and obviously we need to look at statutes and case law. But I was also going to say in regards to Universal's exclusion, the third reason it's invalid is because it does violate Nevada statutory law. And in particular, NRS 485.3091 states that every policy of insurance, automobile insurance, must provide coverage for the named insured and any permissive user. By virtue of this exclusion, Universal is in essence saying our policy does not provide coverage. That violates the statute, and as such, the Universal policy must be conformed to comply with Nevada statutory law. But I also recognize, and again, I believe it's clear that the universal exclusion is invalid, but I recognize that this court doesn't even get to the second issue, that is the validity of that exclusion, unless it first decides the first issue by determining that Benchmark's policy language allows it to interplead the policy limits, and that interpleader constitutes an exhaustion so as to eliminate and end Benchmark's duty to defend.
Because is that an ambiguity? What does it mean to exhaust? What does it take to exhaust?
As this court has indicated, whether or not an ambiguity even exists is purely a question of law. And interpreting a policy, a contract, this court will give the words their plain, ordinary, and common meaning. This court will not rewrite policy provisions that are unambiguous. This court has consistently in the past looked at dictionaries for plain, ordinary, and common meaning of a word. Under both case law, under regular dictionaries, and under law dictionaries, the word exhaust has a clear and plain meaning, which means to use up, to expend completely. When the policy limits have been used up such that they no longer exist, it has been exhausted. And the court, and I've cited numerous cases in my brief, have uniformly held that this language is unambiguous. I've cited case after case after case from other courts which have so held. And in fact, the other parties to this appeal do not even contend that the words themselves are ambiguous. What they do try to contend is that the words are not ambiguous, but the manner in which they are applied is ambiguous. Since the benchmark policy language simply says that the duty to defend ends once the policy limits have been exhausted, period, it does not specify exhausted by how.
And that's kind of an interesting point, especially in light of the kind of unusual facts here. There was no liability found against Sparks, or there was no monetary damages, and so it's essentially Benchmark said, okay, here we're going to interplead all this money, and then it's still there.
But at the time the money was interpled, the lawsuit was still going on, and it was up in the air what would ultimately happen at the time of the trial and or what would ultimately happen at the time of the appeal when this court heard that appeal. So at the time Benchmark's duty to defend should have ended, there was still a potential for liability. And under the law, the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. It's not simply enough for Universal to say, look, there was no monetary award, therefore we don't have a duty to defend. The duty to defend exists at the moment that situation arises. And at the time that situation arose, there was still that possibility of indemnification, of liability, and therefore the duty to defend still existed.
So, Mr. Bick, when did your client's policy exhaust? At the time the jury verdict came back?
Because of the state of this case, there has never been a determination that the policy has, in fact, been exhausted, because the district court denied the motion for summary judgment in which Benchmark asked the court, once the policy limits had been interpled, to rule that that constituted an exhaustion. If the court had granted that motion, then as of the date of that order, then we would have had a judicial determination that the policy limits had been exhausted and the duty to defend had ended.
But you I'm sorry for interrupting. Did you want to finish your thought before I ask the question?
Just trying to sum up, from that point forward, the duty to defend should have rested with Universal Underwriters. So the duty to defend should have ended at the time the court should have granted the motion for summary judgment.
I'm just trying to clarify your position. If Benchmark had obtained summary judgment while the lawsuit was still pending and the potential for liability still existed for your insured, your obligation to defend would have ended before the verdict came back?
The answer is yes, and let me explain why. And again, we have two different insurance companies here. We have Benchmark, which was primary by statute.
No,
we
I
have
got
Universal,
that.
Which is excess by statute.
I'm just talking about Benchmark's duty defend responsibility. Stated another way, can Benchmark terminate its duty to defend while the litigation is pending and the potential for liability of your insured is still pending?
The answer is yes, and again, let me explain why. The duty to defend did not exist at common law. The duty of an insurance company to defend an insured is strictly contractual in nature and therefore turns on the language of the policy. And by the same token, since the duty to defend turns on the language of the policy, depending upon how it's worded, may provide a means by which the duty to defend will end. Now, in making that argument, I'm aware of this court's previous decisions, and it may be what you're alluding to in the mm-hmm. home savings case, mm-hmm. wherein this court stated that once the contractual duty to defend exists, The duty is ongoing and continues throughout the course of the litigation. And that's a case that's been argued by the other two parties to this appeal, saying, look, everything else Mr. Vick is saying makes no sense because here's this case, the duty is ongoing. But as I pointed out in the reply brief, the duty to defend is not never-ending. This court was not faced with the question in the home savings decision as to whether or not the policy language could provide a means by which the duty to defend could end, even though the litigation is still ongoing. So that decision or that issue was never decided by this court. Furthermore, in reaching that issue of law or that statement of law, this court relied upon a California Supreme Court decision. The California Supreme Court has since clarified its position and said the duty to defend continues throughout the course of the litigation or until it is shown that there is no further potential for coverage. In other words, if there is no further basis...
Potential for coverage or potential for liability?
Says no further potential for coverage was the language in the court. But I've also cited the cases that say when there is no further basis by which there is a duty to indemnify, then the duty to defend ends. Because if you can't be held liable anymore, you can't indemnify. You've exhausted your policy limits. There's no further basis by which the insurance company can pay something when it has nothing left to pay. So it's strictly a contractual issue. And you have to look at the language of the contract, which is what I've been trying to emphasize in these briefs, because the language has changed the years. And relying upon older cases, as Universal was able to convince the district court in which they cited in their brief, is dangerous because it's interpreting different language. So this is strictly a contractual matter.
Well, let me ask you this. Don't you have an obligation to go forth with the litigation and put on a defense in cases where you haven't stipulated to liability? Once liability is stipulated, then you have an issue to where those obligations may end. But if you haven't stipulated to liability, don't you really have an obligation to go forward to see if there ultimately is any judgment entered, or perhaps you get a defense verdict and you've not exposed your insured to excess risk?
And again, I keep coming back to the fact that the duty to defend is contractual in nature, and you have to look at the language of the contract. What does the contract require or obligate the insurance company to do? And can that duty to defend end by having the policy limits exhausted?
Anticipating a potential finding of liability and damages up to the policy limit.
Right. In this particular case, it was a wrongful death case, serious injuries, and Benchmark had a minimum policy limits of $1,530. And I believe there was no question, and it was confirmed in light of the subsequent jury verdict of $12.5 million, the potential damages were going to exceed it. But again, it's important that we have to look at the language of the policy. And I've cited all these cases from around the court which said the duty to defend can end. And in fact, if you look at the treatise, Appleman's Insurance Law and Practice, it specifically said once the primary insurer exhausts its policy limits, it has no further duty to defend, and the cost of further defense will lie with the excess carrier, which in this case should have been Universal. Mr. Sparks would not have been prejudiced in any way. Universal should have stepped up to the plate and picked up his defense. And I've cited cases under this policy language, not these old cases that the other parties are citing, but cases from 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, in which the courts have ruled that interpleader does constitute an exhaustion within the meaning of this particular policy language. And once it's been exhausted, the duty to defend ends pursuant to the language of the policy.
Mr. Bick, forgetting Universal for a moment, which I'm sure counsel would like us to do in this case, but assuming no excess coverage present, it seems like it would defeat the public policy of Nevada for those who purchase minimum coverage policies to be placed in a position of having their duty to defend terminated while major catastrophic litigation is pending. I'm a little bit concerned about that outcome.
I'm glad you brought up that point, and I'm happy to address it. This court has previously stated that there's a strong public policy in this state to protect the victims, the injured people in automobile accident cases. That has, in fact, by making sure there's insurance coverage. That policy has been met in this case because Benchmark deposited its $30,000 with the court. It didn't say we didn't owe it. They put it out. The victims have been satisfied. And I can't quite forget Universal on that point because Universal, by its argument, is taking the position we don't have any coverage. That would defeat the public policy of making sure there is that, those kind of benefits. But I'm not aware of any case from this court or from any case in this country that has said there's a public policy that you must provide an ongoing defense once you've already exhausted your policy limits. Maybe there's one out there. I haven't seen it. Instead, this is strictly a contractual matter. What have the parties agreed to in the contract? And the contract says the duty to defend ends once the policy limits have been exhausted, period. And I see my time is up, so I would thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bick. Mr. Knave.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bill Knave, and I represent appellant and respondent Robert M. Sparks. I only have 5 minutes, and I'm going to reserve two. My client is kind of the victim here of an internecine war between the carriers. I join in Universal's argument with regard to the exhaustion portion of that appeal, and I join in Mr. Bick's appeal or arguments with regard to the excess carrier's responsibilities. Therefore, and because I have so little time, I want to talk about just the public policy and to put this into a perspective that we all understand. Here you have a young man. He's facing a potentially ruinous lawsuit. We know it was, and it was potentially ruinous from the second it was filed. He had a death case. It's horrible. He has a 1530 policy, and his carrier dutifully steps up and defends. Now, any reasonable excess carrier is going to look at the facts of this case and know right off the bat those limits are gone. They're no matter when they're paid, they're gone. It's either going to be by the interpleader or by the judgment, but they're gone. So think about it. This is an excess policy that my client tried to avail himself of. Excess coverage. It provided $500,000 worth of a limit so that the plaintiff could be compensated in case my client was found liable. And so what does this excess carrier do? It says that how much we will pay provision buried in pages of a policy that no objectively reasonable insured could really expect to find or understand, that not only are they going to limit their coverage, but they're going to say we have no responsibility whatsoever if the underlying carrier has minimum coverage as required by the law in the state in which the jurisdiction in which the case is pending. So it requires the insured to know what that law is. And then it says, if that happens, we have absolutely no responsibility. And the fact that this is an excess policy, excess, becomes irrelevant. Your Honors, I submit to you that as a matter of Nevada law, that is an illusory provision as applied to the facts of this case, because my young man, my client, should have been protected, should have known when these guys were filing an interpleader action trying to get out of their duty to defend, that at least he had the benefit of an excess policy when they're saying they've exhausted limits and Universal says no. That cannot be the state of the law in the state of Nevada. It just cannot.
Well, what are you pointing to specifically for authority for your point?
Well, I put everything I can into my brief, so I will rely on my briefs. There's nothing directly on point, and I will submit that, except as to say that escape clauses are unlawful as a matter of Nevada law. I just think it's illusory as a matter of law.
So you can't limit your liability in any way? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, you can, but Your Honor, you can't say that you're providing excess coverage and provide no coverage at all. If, for example, they had limited it to an additional 1530, as required by the statute here, then maybe they'd have a little bit better argument. At least that would be some excess coverage. But in this case, they took a premium and provided excess coverage and then said, oops, but by the way, if it turns out that you benefited by another carrier, your own self-protection, you buy the minimum coverage, then you go ahead and exhaust it. Sorry, no coverage.
What statutory provision requires, once the minimum statutory coverage is satisfied, that there be excess coverage in the first event be applicable?
But that's exactly why I think there's a duty to defend, because here we have the carrier who is saying, here's our money. Here is our money. And I'm glad that you guys are going to hear this case and tell us what the law is on exhaustion here, because it's not clear. But once they say that, What is my insured supposed to do? He thinks that he's, you know, we've investigated for him. We found a $500,000 excess policy, and the excess carrier says, sorry, it's really not excess coverage at all. What it is as long as you've got the $15,000 provided by the primary carrier, that's it. That's all you get. That cannot be allowed to stand. I respectfully submit to you, because otherwise, calling this an excess policy is it just belies what it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nave. Mr. Ben-David.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeff Ben-David, Moran Law Firm, representing Universal Underwriters as the respondent in this matter. I can tell you, Your Honor, listening to the arguments, I can answer some of the questions that have been asked, because some of those questions have not been answered. And I think they haven't been answered on purpose, because the answer is really not good. What we're forgetting here, and we being Sparks and Benchmark, is that Sparks was found zero damages at trial. So the arguments you're making about whether this 1530 policy under Universal applies is moot. This court's already found that it's moot. There's an order saying it's moot. The only issue is these defense costs. And the defense cost claim, I don't want to lose sight of, does not exist. And what I mean by that, Your Honor, is after summary judgment was granted for Universal Underwriters, Benchmark, which was its goal from the very beginning, was to dump this 1530 policy that it signed the moment this accident occurred and the moment the lawsuit was filed, and get out of there and not provide a defense whatsoever. That was their goal. They filed summary judgment to try to get that done, and it was denied. Our countermotion for summary judgment was granted based on the most will pay provision. The court found that the language was clear, unambiguous, and ruled that it was limiting and was permissible limiting. And I will get into whether we're really in excess or not in a second. I'll get into that. But most importantly, what happened after that is that Benchmark files a motion for summary judgment to tender its policy limits, to deposit it with the court, and then ask the court to be relieved or released of any further obligations to defend Spark. She denied that portion and said, you can deposit the funds. Dissatisfied with that, Benchmark then does what? They file a motion to amend their complaint to include a new claim for these defense costs. The court denied that motion to amend. To this day, that claim has never been made. They are here asking you to skip the lower court and rule that Universal owes the defense costs because their policy was deposited with the court. The lower court has never heard this case. To this day, it's never been filed. Now, Benchmark agrees. They say, that's true. We have not filed that claim. The lower court has never denied that claim. The lower court has never heard that claim. What they're arguing is that after this court decides the exhaustion issue, then they can maybe bring the claim later. And that's in their briefs. So as we stand today, they have no standing to argue that this defense claim can be made against Universal. Now, where does that take us? It takes us to the exhaustion claim. What they want to use is they want to call Universal the excess policy, and it was, you know, Sparks relied on this excess policy, and he had a right to it. And I'll give you the best quote I've heard today, which was, Mr. Sparks' counsel just says they took the premium, but then refused to provide the policy. Well, let's back up. Universal is not Benchmark's excess carrier, and it's not Sparks' excess carrier. Universal wrote a policy for the dealership that was sued. under the statute, which is NRS 690B, requires that a vehicle, if you own a dealership, I'll just summarize, if you own a dealership, you have to have a policy on every vehicle you own. And so that vehicle had a policy on it. Mr. Sparks had no expectation whatsoever of that policy. Benchmark had no expectation of that policy. No one bought it except the dealership. Mr. Sparks was not an employee. He was a test driver. And as a test driver, the statute says the operator of a vehicle's the operator of a vehicle's insurance policy is first, is primary, which was Benchmark. We became the excess or secondary insurance policy, not because he purchased it and had an expectation of that policy, but because it was there by statute. There's a major difference there, and I'll get into that in a second. The issue of exhaustion.
Well, he's a named insured under your policy.
He's a permissive user under the policy. He's not actually named. It's Mr. Sparks.
Well, I understand that, but he is an insured under your policy, is he not?
He is, as a permissive user, Your Honor, and it was, I will get into that policy in a second. I can answer that now, but yes, he was a permissive user. They argued he was a permissive user. The court ordered he was a permissive user. But however, it doesn't negate the fact that there is a limiting clause of the most we will pay provision. That's the provision that we keep hearing about, of how that affects them. But what Benchmark wants to say is this. They want
Well, what's
this.
Your view about the California case that says, and others, that says those provisions are not conspicuous?
The escape clause? Well, Your Honor, I brought the policy with me. And we have cases right here in Nevada, which I thought was interesting. Instead of citing the California cases he cited, he simply could have cited the Nevada cases that address those issues. Estate of Neal versus Farmers Insurance Exchange argued that. It said the exclusion clause is enforceable in Nevada as long as it provides the minimum coverage required by statute. And that's exactly what this clause did. Now, what they're arguing is this. They're saying, hey, and by the way, I did raise this in my brief. They did, for the first time, argue this. They didn't argue that these were exclusionary clauses. This was an escape clause at the lower court. What they're arguing is a different section was conspicuous. Sparks says, yeah, you're right. We didn't argue that at the lower court, but we did bring it up for a different section. And I think that is the most important issue with regards to this issue alone. Now, I honestly believe this issue is completely irrelevant and moot because of what the trial court had and the fact that we're not his excess carrier in terms of to the extent that he purchased a policy. But I brought the policy with me, Your Honor, and it has been put into the record and is part of the record. Now, what they say is that it's buried on page 50 or something and it's conspicuous and nobody could find it. Well, first of all, it first appears, the clause we're talking about, which is the most we'll pay provision, on 2B, under the notice section. Page 2B has that provision in it. That was argued on the lower court as well. Then you skip to page, I'm going to skip to page 42 because 42 is the best page. 42 is entitled, Who is an Insured? This is the page that Benchmark and Sparks both relied on to say that Sparks was actually an insured as a permissive user under this section. On page 42, they relied entirely on that page to say he's an insured. Now, they didn't find it conspicuous then. Now, Sparks said, oh, it's conspicuous, and this section's conspicuous, yet relied on it at the lower court to say, this is where I'm an insured. So apparently it wasn't conspicuous because they were able to find it and say that he was insured under that provision. All they had to do was take this page and turn it, and the next section is the most we will pay. Now, to argue that's conspicuous, Your Honor, after they rely on page 42 to argue he's an insured, they simply had to turn the page to say the most we'll pay provision is right there, I think is not a stretch. It's an argument they're throwing out at this level. They couldn't even throw that out at the trial court level. Now, where does that take us, though? Benchmark argues page 12 of the reply brief, and I think that sums up the issue. Page 12, it says, an escape clause is an insurance provision whereby coverage purports to disappear in the presence of other insurance. Courts view such escape clauses with disfavor since the insured pays premium for coverage but yet does not receive coverage due to the operation of the clause. Okay. He didn't pay for the coverage. He didn't buy a coverage. He didn't get this in the mail and said, in exchange for your policy premiums, here's your policy, and then he couldn't understand the policy. This was a policy that was on the vehicle itself that he obtained after the accident occurred.
So you're suggesting that we should ignore coverage for permissive users expressly provided for in your client's policy.
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is the arguments that
just
are found...
Just because they didn't pay the premium the dealership did. That would be novel.
Actually, what I'm saying is this, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the argument of conspicuousness and the argument of an escape clause is reserved for the insured. In other words, Sparks could make that argument against Benchmark if they tried to make that same argument with regards to their policy. To argue that, hey, I didn't get notice, because that's really what it's based on. When you argue conspicuousness and you argue that, you're saying, I didn't get notice that that limiting clause was in there, why would I have never bought the policy?
You're saying it's the dealership's claim to make.
That's correct. That's exactly right, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is this. If you take a look at Sparks, I want to address Sparks' issue here before my time runs out. Sparks has a purely hypothetical claim against Universal, and they freely admit that. The claim is only if Benchmark makes a claim against Sparks for reimbursement would then Sparks maybe have a claim against Universal. To this date, and it's part of the record, Benchmark has never made a claim against Sparks, has never made a demand for reimbursement of those attorney's fees, has never made a claim or a lawsuit has never been filed by Benchmark against its insured, by the way, Sparks. That's never occurred either. So what we have is a purely hypothetical argument by Sparks at the highest court level saying, if this happens in the future, I want you to rule on it now that that duty shifts to Universal. That's Sparks' entire claim against Universal.
Why doesn't your most we will pay provision violate 4853091?
Because it does provide for the minimum coverage. And it does state that in the coverage. It
says... Isn't implicit in that the duty to defend?
I think as a secondary, then you jump back to the exhaustion issue. I think, well, yes, well, I think
well, no.
It could
I
be.
Mean, why isn't Sparks entitled... We've talked about excess.
Yes.
But why, if you are obligated under that statute to provide the minimum coverage, why isn't implicit in that obligation a duty to defend Sparks?
We didn't argue that.
Not as an excess, but as a direct responsibility.
Well, first
they're
of
a
all,
permissive user under the policy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why aren't they able to make a claim against you as to defend the action?
Because we
if
would
you
have,
are required by that statute to provide that minimum coverage.
We were actually, Your Honor, the statute says that you have to provide the secondary mm-hmm. after the operator.
Okay.
He has an insurance policy. So what happens is Benchmark, as the primary, has that duty and can't walk away from that duty.
Got it.
Had he not had any insurance and he was uninsured, that would have kicked in. The 1530 would have been provided in any amount.
Would that have included a
yes.
duty to defend?
Yes. Had he not had insurance. But he did. And that's what the provision provides. You're secondary for that purpose. In other words, the Nevada legislature, when they created that statute, wanted protection on the vehicle of whoever drove that car in case they didn't have insurance. But he did. And so the statute works. The operator has primary insurance. What Benchmark wants is they want public policy. They want this court to make law in Nevada that says an insurance company can walk into court on the first day that they write their 1530 policy, see a claim and say, ooh, that's a big claim, run over to district court, deposit their $15,000, $30,000 policy, and walk away from any obligation of its insurer. That's what they want you to rule today, which would mean any time they write any of these policies, a $15,000 policy, a $30,000 policy, a $100,000 policy, doesn't matter. They could walk in day one in district court, file an interpleader action, deposit those funds, and then say, that's exhaustion, and now we don't owe him a defense.
So let me ask you this. If you had a properly crafted provision in your contract, could you do that? Or what public policy prevents that? Or what statutory provision prevents that? Or Nevada case authority would prevent that?
I think what prevents that is, well, there's the United National Frontier case that says you must provide a defense. That's a Nevada case that says you must provide a defense to the insured throughout the course of litigation.
But if you've exhausted your... obligation, which is the question here.
And have you exhausted? That's the issue, Your Honor.
That's the question in this case.
Sure. And that question, Your Honor, has been answered. You know, and in fact was answered I'm permitted to answer this?
I'm going to allow you to answer Justice Perriguer's question, and then, of course, your time has lapsed.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, that has actually been answered, because we have seen cases, and his comment was is that all these old cases keep getting cited, but yet there's a 2006 case, and that's a case we did cite, and I think it's in Sparks' briefs as well. It's the Insurance Company for State of Pennsylvania versus Central Guard and Pet Company, which is a Northern District, a U.S. District Court case in California. And that court said the tender of a policy does not terminate an insured's obligation to defend. It further held that the tender did not exhaust for the purposes of terminating its defense obligations to an insured, and such an act was nothing more than a ploy by the insurance company to get out of paying for its insured's defense. And it took a step further, and this is a 2006 case, Your Honor.
And then you're going to finish your thought.
Thank you. Finish it.
Please.
Thank you. That court ruled, Your Honor, that only the exhaustion of the policy has occurred when the on a payment of settlement or verdict, not posting. And I think that's the difference in the case as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van David. Mr. Bick, and I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking up where Mr. Van David just left off, he directs the court's attention to this federal case from California, but what he fails to mention is that the policy language in that case says the duty to defend ends once the policy limits have been exhausted by payment of judgments or settlements. That's the language we don't have in this case. That's the older language that existed starting in 1966, and therefore the interpretation of that policy provides no guidance here. But what is significant about that particular case, this federal case from Northern District of California, is that the court recognized that if you do comply with the language of the policy, that does terminate the duty to defend before the litigation is open. So that case actually supports the position and the argument that we're making in this case. Mr. Ben David makes much of the fact that we haven't brought a claim against anyone at this point. And the reason we haven't is because we don't have a basis for a claim yet. Unless and until a court rules that we have exhausted our policy limits, we can't make a claim. And in fact, when Benchmark filed a motion to amend in the district court denied the motion as being moot, saying, I've already ruled that Universal was out of the case and that you haven't exhausted your policy. So we can't file a claim until a court tells us we have a claim. And that's what we're asking this court to do, to reverse the district court, at which time we will have that claim. And again, I think, Justice Perriguer, you've made an excellent point, and Justice Hardesty as well, about 485.3091. It says the policy must provide coverage to the named insured and any permissive user. It doesn't say anything in there. If you have insurance from somebody else, your policy doesn't have to provide coverage. It says the policy must. And by that statute alone, Universal's provision violates Nevada law and is invalid because they're trying to say our policy does not provide coverage. The statute obligates them to do so. So what we need to keep in mind is the policy language is unambiguous. In fact, in its own policy, Universal Underwriters has that same language.
Finish your thought.
Thank you. Therefore, since it's unambiguous, the interpretation of the language is strictly a matter of law for the court. The way the language is worded under the modern language that's being used in these standard policies, and under every case I've cited, including 2009, 2008, 2007, 2006, interpreting that language, they have held that the clear language allows interpleader, and clearly interpleader constitutes an exhaustion of the policy limits.
You're not saying there's not cases contrary to that position?
If there are, there aren't very many, because we're
there's
talking
few,
about fairly,
I've seen them.
Fairly recent language. If you look at cases, it's always important to look at the language in those cases and exactly what was stated in the policy. And there's a ton of cases that interpret different policy language and say exhaustion is not accomplished by interpleader. But if you look at this particular language, and admittedly, this court has an opportunity to be at the forefront of perhaps not only saying the law in this state, but giving guidance around the country. But at least those five cases I cited recently under this language, again, don't get confused with different languages. Always important, I want to emphasize, look at how exactly that language is worded. And when you have this language, the duty to defend ends when the policy limits have been exhausted, period.
Thank you, Mr. Bick.
Thank you.
Mr. Nave, you did exhaust all of your time as well, but it seems as if we're stretching time here a bit this morning, so I'll give you an additional minute if you would like.
I'll conclude by saying this. This case perfectly illustrates that if the law in the state of Nevada is going to obligate carriers to provide permissive user coverage, then it better be with a concomitant duty to defend, because my guy could have ended up here with a carrier saying we're gone and a carrier saying we have no coverage with a catastrophic loss that would have hurt him, and it would have been a disservice to the plaintiffs and a disservice to public policy in the state. And I hope you keep that in mind while you're fashioning your opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nave. Mr. Bick, Mr. Ben David, Mr. Nave, thank you very much for your time and your attention. This case will stand submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.